My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me now and we will explore these topics and so much more with fascinating guests, authors, and experts who will guide us to Destination Unlimited. Growing up in the 50s and 60s in Brooklyn, New York, I often heard stories that today we would call urban legends, about evil beings and people. Often told by older kids, camp counselors, and some adults, these stories were designed to frighten, perhaps intimidate, and most definitely nurture nightmares. These were the pre-digital, pre-cyberspace days, and storytelling was a verbal art form. With the advent of the internet, apps, and social media, the dissemination of these stories has become immediate, widespread, and sometimes with profound and tragic results. Such is the story of the Slender Man, a character birthed as a creepypasta internet meme in 2009 that not only frightened young imaginations, but resulted in the tragic stabbing of a 12-year-old girl by two classmates in 2014. Is Slender Man a modern phenomena, or does it go much deeper historically and deeper into our psyches? My guest this week on Destination Unlimited is Nick Redfern. Nick is the author of more than 40 books on the strange, mysterious, and unexplained. He's appeared on more than 70 television shows, including Ancient Aliens, America's Book of Secrets, The Unexplained Files, and UFO Hunters. His website is Nick Redfern. Fortean.blogspot.com. That's Nick Redfern, Fortean, Fortean.blogspot.com. And he joins me this week to talk all things mysterious and discuss his new book, The Slender Man Mysteries, An Internet Urban Legend Comes to Life. Welcome to Destination Unlimited, Nick Redfern. Good evening, Nick.
Hey, Victor. Thanks for having me on again.
Wonderful to have you back. It's been a couple of years since we last chatted. So please share with our listeners a little bit of your story and how you got on the path of investigating and writing about the paranormal and the mysterious.
Well, my interest in this sort of paranormal issues, I guess, go back to when I was about 6 or 7, and my parents took me on a week's vacation to Scotland, and while we were there we spent a day at Loch Ness, and my dad told me the story of the Loch Ness monster. And you know, as a young kid, that sort of got me sort of excited and, you know, intrigued by all this. And I suppose when I was 11 or 12 I started to you know, read books on the subject. I think one of the earliest I read was John Keel's Mothman Prophecies and some of Brad Steiger's books and things like that. And then when I finished school, I began working on a magazine, and did that for a couple of years, and then thought, well, why not try and combine the interest in the paranormal with the background I'd done with journalism, you know, on the magazine. And that's sort of pretty much what began it all, was with that trip to Loch Ness.
Now, did you ever have any personal paranormal experiences of your own prior to that time?
No. I mean, I sort of take more of an approach. I have had a few weird experiences over the years, but for the most part, I'd sort of take a detached approach. You know, I relate what the witnesses have told me, and you know, look out for corroborative information. You know, I prefer to take like a journalistic approach to what I do, you know, sort of researching and writing and putting the story out for people to see, rather than, you know, me sort of you know, talking about from my perspective. I think it's important to get the story is the important thing, rather than me jumping in every 10 minutes and saying this or that, you know.
Well, just would you be willing to share one of the weird experiences that you've had with us?
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the things I do get is, particularly when I'm investigating paranormal stuff, is I get a lot of conspiracy, I get a lot of synchronicities. You know, for people who aren't aware of what synchronicities are, the idea of like a meaningful coincidence. In other words, something happens in your life which seems like a coincidence, but it's so bizarre because it sort of helps you on the path that you're currently then looking into, you know, the very whichever phenomena. And it seems that it happened in such a strange, bizarre way that it's difficult not to take the view that there was some sort of like higher intelligence manipulating situations to push you down that particular path. So I get a lot of those, and I think I always tell people, don't ignore synchronicities, because I think they are they're an important aspect of paranormal research. And I don't pretend to know why it happens, but people do get these weird synchronicities, and you know, it's a sort of fascinating aspect of the phenomenon.
That's actually the story of my life for the last 40 years, and how these synchronicities have come, and how by paying attention, you know, a lot of times things happen in our lives, and we say, okay, it happened, it's a coincidence, whatever it is, and we let it go, and we don't pay attention. But sometimes if we pay attention, especially to those that seem extremely unusual to us, it'll actually help us to grow on whatever path we've chosen in our lives, or what other path perhaps has been chosen for us. So I think your point is well taken on that. Now, you refer to your work as Fortean, a reference to Charles Fort. Who was Charles Fort, and how did he influence your work?
Well, Charles Fort was someone who many, many decades ago, or a century ago, he was someone who had a deep interest in the world of the paranormal, and his books included Wild Talents and Low. And essentially, he was a collector and disseminator of data on paranormal phenomena, particularly newspaper and magazine and journal articles and news stories. And he would sort of voraciously collect these stories and then put them in his books and try and understand and figure out what was going on. And he would collect reports of paranormal phenomena, strange things in the sky, weird creatures, you know, long before the terms like Bigfoot, you know, and Loch Ness Monster existed. So he was very much someone who covered an entire range of paranormal phenomena in his research, and that's kind of what I do, you know. People sometimes call me like a cryptozoologist or a monster hunter or a UFO researcher, which is part of what I do, but, you know, having an interest in multiple different phenomena, I don't sort of consider myself as a UFO investigator. I consider myself as an investigator of the paranormal, and part of that paranormal investigation can involve the UFO subject. I know it's kind of like splitting hairs, but you know what I mean. I kind of view myself as someone who covers numerous aspects of the paranormal rather than being labeled as a flying saucer seeker or whatever.
Well, what you're doing is there's many, many mysteries in our world, and you're looking at all of those mysteries, and I think that's a beautiful thing to do. I think that a lot of people in their mundane lives sort of get hung up in their day-to-day life, and that when someone like you comes along and shares the mysterious with us, it gives us something to look at, look forward to and look at.
Well, you know, I mean, I think there's a lot of people out there, well, I know there are a lot of people out there like me that are fascinated by these mysteries, and I feel, you know, it's like, whether it's a book or going to a conference and lecturing or doing a radio show, you know, we're all in it together. That's the way I look at it. You know, you've got your show, you have your listeners, I write the book, somebody else blogs, somebody gives a lecture. But we're all looking for the same thing. So we're part of a community. And I feel that if I can hopefully, you know, add something that's to people's lives, which they're going to get some information from and satisfaction from and insight, you know, I feel that's the right thing to do. And as I said, I think we are all kind of like a community, even though perhaps sometimes people don't see it like that, but we are. And I think it's good to share information with like-minded people, as I said, who may hopefully get something from it as well.
Absolutely. Now, my last interview with you was a couple of years back, and we were talking about your latest book at that time, which was Secret History, Conspiracies from Ancient Aliens to the New World Order. And prior to that, we talked about your zombie book. What have you been up to since then?
Well, again, you know, as I said, I cover a lot of different things. So in the last couple of years, I've done a book on the Chupacabra mystery, one on Bigfoot, a Roswell book, and I've got one on shapeshifters, the legends and folklore and history of shapeshifting creatures. So, you know, I've sort of been covering all corners of the map, so to speak, really.
Let's talk about the Chupacabra real brief. What did you find when you were working, researching the Chupacabra?
Well, I mean, there's two sides to the Chupacabra angle, Victor. One is that you have the original Chupacabra reports from Puerto Rico, which describe this strange two-legged creature with these spikes down its head and neck. And then you have this sort of hairless dog-like Chupacabra that most people know of today in the United States. And so the book was sort of written in the flavor of how I did the investigations, which was sort of road trip based. You know, I always think, particularly when you're dealing with investigations into strange creatures, it's important to actually get out there and look for them. And I've been to Puerto Rico now on many occasions, sort of, you know, trekking through the El Yunque rainforest and the various little towns and villages and speaking to people about their experiences. And, you know, there's no doubt in my mind there's a real Chupacabra phenomenon. Now, the big question, of course, is what these creatures are. But the book itself, which is called Chupacabra Road Trip, it is sort of written, you know, in the flavor of and the spirit of a road trip, you know, sort of jumping in the vehicle and heading out into the night and, you know, hacking your way through the trees, etc. And from a first person perspective, you know, and I think the feedback I get is that people like those kind of books because they feel they're on the journey as well. You know, it's not just sort of bland writing of, like, a historical look at the Chupacabra. It's sort of one man's quest to go out on expeditions and find these things.
In my next lifetime, I want to come back as Nick Redfern. My guest this week on Destination Unlimited is Nick Redfern. He's the author of The Slender Man Mysteries, An Internet Urban Legend Comes to Life, and we'll be back with more of Nick and these wonderful mysteries after these words on the Ohm Times Radio Network.
Ohm Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Ohm Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week is Nick Redfern. We're going to be discussing his book, The Slender Man Mysteries, an internet Urban Legend Comes to Life. So, Nick, about 3 years ago, the Slender Man story became part of my work. I was called when I was doing active paranormal investigation to work with a family whose young son, I believe he was 6 or 7 at the time, was complaining about being haunted by a being that he referred to as the Slim Man, and described him as a slim, tall man. And we did our investigation. We found nothing of a paranormal nature in this home. And then I asked the boy how he first saw or heard about this being, or saw this being, and he pointed to the computer. So we looked up, and he showed us what this character was all about. How did you become interested in the Slender Man phenomena?
Well, I think more than anything else, it was the realization that what began as essentially like an internet meme was becoming something far more. In other words, it was developing to a point where this wasn't just a piece of online entertainment for many kids. It was becoming something that they quite literally believed in, and the lines between sort of fiction and reality became blurred, and people began to sort of associate the Slender Man with not just the world of the internet and, you know, fictional stories, but something that had sort of strode out of the world of fiction right into the heart of the real world, our world. And then people started to claimed they'd seen the Slender Man. As you said, you know, in the middle of the night, people would wake up and see this tall, skinny figure in a black suit and a faceless face staring at them or looming over them. And there are so many stories like this. And, of course, that sort of begs the question, is it some sort of mass psychosis? Or the one theory, you know, the idea that if enough people believe in something, can it actually be brought to life, you know, with the intense subconscious acceptance that the Slender Man is real? Does it actually, in a very strange way, bring some aspect of the Slender Man into our reality?
Now, tell us about the modern genesis of Slender Man. You mentioned the internet meme. How did that come to be?
Well, what happened was that in 2009, the Something Awful website, as it's called, had a, not so much like a competition, but like, a challenge. Who could come up with the creepiest boogeyman type character for the internet era? And the guy who sort of so-called won, so to speak, was a guy named Eric Knudsen, and he came up with the idea and the imagery of the Slender Man. Now, for people who aren't aware fully of what the Slender Man looks like, when Knudsen created it, he actually was inspired by like the writings of people like H.P. Lovecraft, and also things like the stories of the Men in Black, and various sort of gothic horror type tales. And so he created the Slender Man to be like a sort of 7 to 8 foot tall, very skinny character in a black suit, white shirt, black tie, sort of spidery, long, skinny legs and arms sort of reaching down to the knees. And it had this, as I said, like a faceless face, no eyes, no nose, no mouth, but just like sort of like a vague imprint as to where they should be. And it had these octopus-like tentacles coming out of its back, which could reach forward and grab people. And so it was very sort of like a creepy, nightmarish type of creature. And what Knudsen also did, which and I should stress to people, you know, this wasn't like a hoax. It was just a competition kind of thing on the internet. There was no deceit or anything like that. It wasn't meant to be a real creature that was actually a fictional story. It was the exact other way around. And Knudsen skillfully made sort of a couple of old black and white photographs where he basically sort of implanted into the photographs pictures of the Slender Man as well, in situations where there are bunches of kids. So what happened was that almost immediately the Slender Man was seen as sort of a dangerous figure, and particularly dangerous to children and young people. And very, very quickly, the phenomenon or the issue of the Slender Man became a phenomenon. Blogs were created, an online series of episodes of like a fictional type story were uploaded to YouTube and caught the imagination of literally hundreds of thousands of people. And the whole thing within literally like 10 days became like a definitive phenomenon. And, you know, the Slender Man was here, there, and everywhere. Now, this was 2009, but by sort of late 2010, at the very latest, things began to change when it went from just being, you know, something you could read about online and find the latest fictional tale of the Slender Man or the latest cool photograph or whatever. It changed to where people said they'd seen the Slender Man in their bedrooms or in the woods near where they lived and when they were wide awake. And that's when the world of paranormal research sat up and took notice, because something else seemed to be going on that was beyond just, you know, this internet meme. It was sort of, there was this supernatural aspect to it that was starting to develop.
Why do you think that happened?
Well, one of the most popular theories among people who have researched the Slender Man phenomenon is that they look at it from the perspective of what is known as the Tolpa phenomenon. Now, a Tolpa, it's essentially a Tibetan term which means thought form. And the concept is that if enough people genuinely believe in something and they fixate on it, and we're talking, you know, hundreds of thousands of people have this imagery of the Slender Man, that either deliberately or inadvertently you can create a real world version of a fictional entity. And the idea is the concept of the tulpa, the thought form, is that the human mind has the ability to construct imagery which it can then externalize and project it outwards, whether knowingly or deliberately or subconsciously. And the concept goes further, suggesting that the thought form, as it gets stronger and more people believe in it, it begins to have a sort of independent existence. So in relation to the concept of the Slender Man, what you have is the original internet meme, and then you have countless people believing in it who then externalize it, which gives birth to a second type of Slender Man, which has nothing to do with the original creation of Eric Knudsen or had nothing to do with the internet, but it's kind of like the mind creates it. And then, of course, it's very difficult to, you know, it's easy to open doors, not quite so easy to close doors behind you sometimes, you know. And that's the concept that the Slender Man has come to life as a thought form, as a tulpa, and is very happy with this strange leash of life that it now has.
Now, you share in your book, The Slender Man Mysteries, the story of Alexandra David Neal. Please tell us her story and how it relates.
Well, yeah, I mean, Alexander Neal's story is a classic one and a perfect one, an analogy to this, because she was someone who had a deep interest in the world of tulpas. And this was actually only because she was someone who essentially stumbled upon it, is probably the best way to describe it more than anything else. But essentially, her story is that she's actually somebody who travelled all around the world and lived to almost to be 101 years of age, and so investigated the paranormal and actually didn't do her any harm, really, I guess. So, but she wrote a book in 1929 called Magic and Mystery in Tibet, and in the book she shared with her readers a very strange and mysterious and even sinister series of events that occurred when she was, opened up to the whole tulpa angle when she was living and working in Tibet. And it was from the Tibetan people, particularly some of the various people in the religious communities in Tibet, told her the concept of the tulpa. And she was fascinated by this, and so she decided to try and create a thought form. And she focused on the image of like a jolly Friar Tuck character from Robin Hood, you know, this sort of jolly, rotund monk, so to speak. And she fixated on this imagery, not just for days or hours, but literally for weeks and months. You know, she would lie down in bed at night and follow the teachings of the Tibetan people, where you almost get yourself into sort of an altered state of mind and just focusing on this image. And she said that the day came when, at one point in the house she was living at the time, she saw this shadowy image out of the corner of her eye, which looked vaguely like a monk type character. And over time, over the next few days and weeks, that shadowy figure became more and more real, if you like, to the point where she could make out, you know, the clothing it was wearing that she'd, sort of fixated on as well. And eventually she said that she could see this monk-type character in her home in sort of a semi-spectral, almost like a ghostly fashion. But then the time came when it was almost indistinguishable between a real person and a thought form. But as often happens in a lot of these stories, the tulpa, the thought form, which now has this new leash on life, becomes sort of troublesome, rebellious, and will not conform to the wishes of the creator. And she said that this sort of like rotund monk-like figure physically began to change, where he became sort of thinner and cheekbones, and you know, he went from this jolly looking face to a very sly, evil face. And to her horror, Alexander David Neal realized that she'd created this thing in her mind, and it now was completely out of her control, and it was turning the tables on her, and you know, becoming aggressive and malevolent. And so she had to approach one of the people who told her how to do this, and to find out now how to try and deconstruct it. Mm. And apparently that was even more difficult than creating it. But eventually this sort of Friar Tuck character, this turned evil, was fragmented and finally was dissolved. But she did not do this ever again, because she felt that it was too dangerous to create these things in the mind, to project them outwards, and then for them to turn the tables and be the ones calling the shots.
My guest is Nick Redfern. He's the author of The Slender Man Mysteries, An Internet Urban Legend Comes to Life. Nick, please tell our listeners where they can get the book and find out more about your work.
Well, yeah, sure. Well, the book's called The Slender Man Mysteries, and it's just been published, and you can get it on Amazon, all good online book services. And you can also buy it off the shelves in Barnes & Noble as well. And people can reach me at my blog, which is nickredfern14.blogspot.com.
And we'll be back with more of Nick Redfern and this amazing story after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
You're listening to OTR-FM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
Humanity Healing International is a small nonprofit with a big dream. Since 2007, HHI has been working tirelessly to bring help to communities with little or no hope. Our projects are not broad mandates, nor are they overnight solutions, but they bring the reassurance that no one is alone and that someone cares. To learn more, please visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week, Nick Redfern. We're talking about his book, The Slender Man Mysteries, An Internet Urban Legend Comes to Life. So you were discussing the experience that Alexandra David Neal had in the construction of this astral being, or this being of the mind, which became reality, called a tulpa, and how she had to deconstruct it afterwards. It's very reminiscent of many of the stories of people who have tried to create life forms. For example, in the ancient Hebrew tradition, they talk about the golem in the story of Frankenstein, Mary Shelley's story Frankenstein, about creating a living being out of dead tissue and reanimating it, and then eventually having to destroy it. This seems to be a common theme, whether it be in fiction or in reality, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, you know, this idea, the concept of creating something which inevitably seems to go wrong, you know, that is something that sort of permeates throughout a lot of stories, and particularly so with these thought forms and tulpas, because it's sort of, I guess for some people, it's sort of a complicated concept, because you're not literally bringing to life the Slender Man as it was created by Eric Knudsen for the internet. You're creating an identical figure. But the thing on the internet has no power or any force beyond, you know, just catching the imagination of people. But then when you externalize it, and there are countless other people doing it, and you have this sort of mind group, if you like, all fixating on this skinny, weird man in black with the tentacles, then you cross over into this other realm. And you find that so many times in these stories of thought forms, where the creator becomes the victim, and has to take steps to try and not just be the victim, but, you know, their life may well be in danger. I mean, Alexander David Neal, she actually felt that at one point, you know, a jolly monk, as it was to start with, was putting her life in danger. I mean, literally.
And is this change, this transformation, whether it be a benign creature to begin with into something more deadly or more threatening, is this the nature of our human mind? Is this our fears manifest, that our friends turn against us, that life turns against us?
Well, I mean, there could be that angle too, because one of the big things about the Slender Man, of course, is that it's a very dangerous, hostile, a negative entity. There's nothing positive about the Slender Man at all. So I think if people fixate on it just in the real world, regardless of the Topper angle, I don't think they might find it intriguing and interesting. But there's also that sort of bogeyman kind of like a strange allure to it. You know, the idea that we all watch horror films. Why? Because you want to be frightened, you know. But it's, we have that, for some reason, our minds enjoy being frightened, providing it's in a setting where it's not real, you know. But when you then start dealing with these entities in the real world, and, you know, the hostility angle comes in, then I think inevitably, you know, the human mind focuses on the negative and the dangerous, because that's all they see emanating from the Slenderman.
Now, in 2014, this actually manifested into a tragic and almost deadly occurrence in Waukesha, Wisconsin. Please tell us about that.
Well, yeah, well, Waukesha, Wisconsin, you know, just a normal, everyday town in Wisconsin, you know, like any other town across the United States. But it was sort of firmly put on the map in 2014, when two young girls, just 12 at the time, launched a savage attack on one of their friends, or former friends, obviously. And basically, she was stabbed, I mean, almost 20 times. It was a, you know, miracle she didn't die. And fortunately, she has actually now recovered and psychologically as well, you know, and she's doing very well, which is good news. The two girls were just recently sentenced, you know, and they're going to be behind closed doors for, you know, for decades for this attack. Now, what sort of really thrust this story into the world's media was the fact that the girls essentially were going to sacrifice their friend to the Slender Man. That was the plan. That was the goal. And it was basically, as they said, they would become the Slender Man's proxy, so to speak. And the girls, like so many other young children, young people, had become obsessed, literally obsessed with the story of the Slender Man. You know, it was on their minds all the time. And the more they got into it, the more they literally were sort of sucked into the whole phenomenon. And to the point where, from their perspective, you know, what they were doing was something that had to be done. And of course, again, you know, this had nothing to do directly with, you know, the Slender Man as it was in, you know, the supernatural angle. It was that they'd just become obsessed with the Slender Man in terms of the stories, etc. But what is weird is that Waukesha actually has a history of strange figures, not unlike the Slender Man, having been seen years before the actual Slender Man phenomenon even begun. So that does sort of give rise to the idea that there's more to it than that in terms of this event in Waukesha. I'll give you an example. Back in the early 1920s, the body of a young boy was found in a pool in Worcestershire, and nobody knew who he was, and his ID was never actually confirmed at all, but he was known by the media at the time as Little Lord Fauntleroy. And the reason why he was given that name was because he was wearing expensive clothes, and so they assumed that he had to be, you know, from a powerful, rich family. When the police got into the story, you know, they tried to find out what happened. Nobody could figure out for sure who he was. There were deep suspicions. Now, a psychic actually looked into this issue of who killed this little boy, this little Lord Fauntleroy, and the killer was described by the psychic as a tall, thin man in a black suit, and she could see this figure carrying the body of the boy through the woods, and woods and the Slender Man are sort of inextricably tied together. Now, another example, one of the people I interviewed for the book, a Wisconsin resident named Mike Huberty, and Mike told me how he had seen this sort of tall, thin, shadowy creature just a couple of miles from where the girls attacked their friend in 2014. But this was back in the 1990s when he saw this thing. So there's a lot of weird stuff concerning Slender Man type figures in Worcestershire that go back to the 1990s with Mike Huberty and back to the early 1920s with this poor, unfortunate little boy who was also killed, and where also there was a tie-in with this tall, slender, creepy figure.
Let's talk about that manifestation. Tall, slender, wearing a dark suit, perhaps a white shirt. What is that image representative of?
Well, I mean, I think on one hand, there's a sort of an authority figure to it, you know. It's sort of back in the 1950s, you know, you would see all these movies about the FBI or whatever, gangsters, you know. Then the FBI, you know, they have the black suit and the fedora hat. It does create like an air of authority to some degree when you see that black suit, white shirt and black tie. But there's also the fact that it's also sort of creates sort of creepy imagery, and particularly so when the figure itself has this sort of pale face, gaunt looking, no eyes, no nose, no mouth. And it sort of creates sort of a nightmarish imagery. And I think the same kind of response or feeling that people get from the Slender Man is the same one they get from the phenomenon of the Men in Black. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, the Men in Black, most people have seen the movies, you know, Tommy Lee Jones, Will Smith, and, you know, they work for this government agency that investigates UFOs and threatens people and tells them to keep quiet. You know, the real reports are actually a little bit different, where they have sort of more supernatural overtones to them, and they're sort of very pale and skinny and ominous, and it's interesting that Eric Knudsen, who created the Slender Man, did say that in part he was inspired by the Men in Black legends and things like that. But that whole angle of the black suit alone, you know, is enough to instill that sort of, kind of fear of authority that some people have. And but then you then mix that with this, you know, this skeletal pale face thing, and then you've really unleashed, you know, sort of the combination of everybody's nightmares, you know.
And the concept of no eyes or not being able to see the eyes or the other features of the face means that you really don't know what the intention of this being is. You can't read their face. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And I think, you know, we don't think about that until it really hits us that I mean, you know, you could meet somebody from the other side of the world and you have no way to speak to that person. But if that person smiles or laughs, you do it back, because it's a universal imagery. Or you give somebody the thumbs up, you know, that, again, you meet somebody, I don't know, in Russia, and they don't speak English, you don't speak Russian, but you can sort of, you know, put your thumb up and high five and everybody's cool, but there's no word spoken. And but you don't have that with the Slender Man. You have a totally emotionless face. I wouldn't even say emotionless. That implies it's ever had emotion, you know. But you're just not able to understand what its motivation is, because there is no emotion there. And as human beings, which, you know, we're highly evolved emotional creatures, we rely on that emotional connection or bond, if you like, and we don't think about it until it's no longer there. And, you know, it's kind of dealing with like a serial killer. How do you get into the mind of somebody who's so deranged that they kill people? You know, most people, we can't figure out what that must be like, because thankfully most people's minds don't work like that. And I think it's the same with the Slender Man, that people are fascinated by it because they try and figure out its motivations without having any real groundwork to use to understand what that motivation might be, because he doesn't give anything away, because there's no look on its face to give away, you know.
My guest is Nick Redfern. We're talking about his new book, The Slender Man Mysteries, An Internet Urban Legend Comes to Life. And we'll be back with more of Nick after these words from the Om Times Radio Network.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose: to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free. AscendingHearts.com.
On Destination Unlimited, my guest this evening is Nick Redfern. He's the author of the new book, The Slender Man Mysteries, An Internet Urban Legend Comes to Life. Nick, in the book, you talk about the relationship to chaos magic with the Slenderman phenomenon. Please explain.
Well, yeah, I mean, chaos magic essentially is very similar to the whole issue of creating things through through the mind, like the tulpa. But chaos magic goes back to actually quite a long time ago now, and it all ties in with probably one of the most famous, if not the most famous, occultists of all time, that being Aleister Crowley. Now, Aleister Crowley is someone who had he was tied up in all sorts of different things. At one point, he was hired to do secret work by British intelligence, the equivalent of the FBI in the UK. And he had a home on the shores of Loch Ness called Beleskin House, where he performed all sorts of weird rituals and rites and ceremonies. But when it comes to chaos magic, this essentially ties in with a lot of Crowley's work in terms of what we would call magic. Now, by magic, you know, today it's been sort of diluted down to, sort of, you know, a guy pulling a rabbit out of a hat or whatever, you know, or cutting a girl in half on stage and then suddenly she's back in one piece again. That's how today we think of magic. Barely a century ago, magic was perceived very different. It was essentially, you know, a ceremonial process as a means to use a supernatural ability or power to achieve a specific goal. And that would sort of involve, at least from the perspective of how the people would perceive it, as sort of contacting various deities and, you know, rituals to open portals and doorways to allow something to come through. And, you know, it would sort of revolve and around things like Faustian pacts, that kind of thing, you know, sort of doing a deal with some sort of supernatural entity. But one of the offshoots of all this was the realization on some of the part of the people who started to look into this angle of what became known as chaos magic, was the idea that you could work with sort of archetypal fictional imageries and use magical rites not unlike the Tulpa situation, to again create something that isn't necessarily real but becomes real. And one of the cases that I actually talk about in the book, which is a very important and significant one as well, it actually revolves around a man named Alan Moore. Now, Alan Moore was, or still is, I should say, he's someone who has a, you know, a background in comic books and movies. He actually created the character Constantine for the 2005 movie of the same name, which starred Keanu Reeves as this sort of demon hunter. And Alan Moore also wrote V for Vendetta, which was a big Hollywood movie production as well. Now, Alan Moore also has a deep interest in the whole angle of chaos magic, and he revealed just a few years ago how, not long after he'd created the Constantine character, and bear in mind, you know, as I said, he's a chaos magician as well, he told a story about how he was sitting in a restaurant on the River Thames in London, England. And keep in mind, this was shortly after he'd created Constantine, the character, and he'd been fixating and focusing on the imagery and how he would appear in the comic book, etc. And suddenly, this figure walked past him with this sort of knowing, sly grin on his face. And it was Constantine, as Alan Moore had envisaged him. The clothing was exactly the same, his face was the same, the hair was the same, everything. And it was almost like a knowing, sly smile, you know, kind of, be careful of what you want, because, you know, it'll appear before you. And Moore was deeply disturbed by this, and still is to this day. You know, it still creeps him out, the idea of, you know, using so these rituals and rites. But also, you know, just fixating on him in terms of actually creating the character for the comic book and putting so much attention and concentration on it, that then suddenly there's Constantine, very briefly, fragmentally, but they're all the same. And so I think, you know, in the same way that the human mind can inadvertently and subconsciously create these thought forms, that chaos magic can also achieve the same goal. But a lot of it does just come to how the human mind focuses on one particular issue or entity, and then, you know, use the magical procedures to try and then bring it into the real world, which, you know, is, that's when it becomes dangerous, because it's like anything, you know, when, like I said earlier, that you open a door, that's easy to do. It's not that easy to always close the door behind you. So.
You know, it's interesting. There was a science fiction movie in the 1950s called Forbidden Planet. I don't know if you've ever seen it, starring Walter Pidgeon. And in that, he would manifest his alter ego as this beast, this creature that would actually come to life and do damage on this planet. And are these all examples, the Slender Man and the story that of Constantine, are these all examples of thought forms becoming self-aware?
Yeah, well, that's where it gets really dangerous, because it's one thing for somebody to create something in the mind and it gets externalized and people see it. But if it's just sort of almost like a, you know, an old video loop playing over and over again, well, it might frighten people, it probably would. But if it's just like an old loop or something, it's not going to hurt anyone. But just about everyone who either adheres to, you know, the teachings of chaos magic, or, you know, the just fixating in your mind on these things, whichever angle you take, the outcome is almost always the same. The stronger the belief in the tulpa, in the thought form, the deeper and stronger the self-awareness of the entity that's been created, you know, it spirals. In other words, you know, you have something that begins as a vague, sort of smoky, shadowy form, very kind of ethereal, seen out the corner of the eye, then perhaps the next week it looks a little bit more formed, and then a few weeks after that it looks just like the Slender Man, and then the Creator in the middle of the night wakes up not able to move properly, which a lot of people talk about, and the creature, the Slender Man, is looming right over them in bed. And then whether they realize it or not, that their mind, by focusing on it, has not just created it, but it's given it its own identity and its own independent identity. It's basically kind of giving birth, but in a supernatural rather than a physical way.
And getting back to the description of the tall, black-suited, white-shirted, black-tied person, isn't that also an image of the Undertaker or death itself?
Well, I mean, that's a good point. I actually hadn't thought of that one. But yeah, I mean, anything that's sort of, you know, black suits, they all, as I said earlier, they all have also have that kind of authority angle to them. But you're right, there is that sort of creepy, ominous aspect too. So
a modern Grim Reaper.
Yeah, well, it is like a modern Grim Reaper. It's also, you know, like a modern-day boogeyman. You know, when we were kids, I mean, stories like that would just be told over campfire situations. The big mm-hmm. difference today is that the Slender Man was created on the internet, where you have instant access to, you know, film footage, stories that people have written, photographs that they've created, you know, YouTube videos, that kind of thing. And so, in other words, the impact is far greater today than it would have been, say, 20, 30 years ago. But yeah, anything that's sort of, you know, a character in a black suit looks weird and creepy. And of course, when you then place that faceless figure in a black suit into the heart of the woods, you know, imagine you're walking down the street, you see a guy in a black suit. You don't think much about it. If you're taking the dog through a, you know, the dense woods near where you live, and there's this guy in a black suit staring at you, that kind of places the man in a black suit in a totally different context in your mind. You know
Absolutely.
What I mean?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You touch upon the belief by some that our reality, what we perceive as reality, is actually a simulation in someone else's reality. Are we someone else's dream, Nick?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's quite literally 100% like that. But, I mean, there is sort of actually a growing belief, even among scientists, that we could be living in something that is kind of the closest thing you can get to, like, in The Matrix. You know, for people who haven't seen The Matrix movies, you know, the real world as we see it is a dream world, and everybody on the planet is actually sort of locked down in these pod-like creations where we live in a dream world. The reality, though, is that we're all controlled by these machines which siphon off electrical energy from the human body as a means to feed them. So essentially we're living in like a factory or you know, a slaughterhouse, and to keep us in our place we're all sort of hooked into this world of the Matrix, which is the world we think we live in. Now, you know, people say, well, there's no way that could be. You know we're awake and we're living in the real world. But, you know, I always say to people, well, you go to bed at night and you dream. And this sort of ties in with one of the phrases in the Matrix movie. You know, the idea that so everybody at some point has a really weird dream that does seem so real. Now, if you didn't wake up from that dream, how would you ever know it was really a dream? You only know it was a dream because we wake up in the morning and then you realize, you know, that was just a nightmare, just a dream, you know, and you thank goodness that it was. But if you didn't wake up, if there was, you know, a machine or machines keeping you asleep endlessly, you would never know. You would think you were really wide awake. And so, you know, the concept of that is an interesting one, because I talk about how, you know, in some respects, the, you know, this virtual reality world, which we can almost live in now through the internet, a number of people have spoken about how they've been investigating the Slender Man mystery and researching it. And then they've had weird experiences of a Slender Man nature in the real world. I mean, one of the people I interviewed for the book, a girl named Lacey, and she's a trainee flight attendant, and she told me how she got really not just interested in the Slender Man phenomenon, but actually got really obsessed with it, and you know, couldn't leave it alone at all. And she said then something really weird happened one night, that she saw like a shadowy image of the Slender Man on her laptop. And then she said that shortly after that, she would hear she heard a message like, it was something along the lines of, "We're friends now." And this sort of really, and quite understandably, freaked her out. And she felt that the internet, because she was fixating on the whole angle of the Slender Man and doing all this research online, she felt, as against some scientists do, felt that the internet is becoming self-aware, and that the things that we search for online in a kind of a strange supernatural way, the Slender Man in this case, that the internet can now kind of almost interact with us because it's becoming more and more powerful and so forth. So, you know, it's a weird aspect to the story, but it's one that more and more people are becoming, I guess, accustomed to, or at least considering in terms of, you know, a digital world becoming a reality, and that reality becoming self-aware to where it can control us.
His book is called The Slender Man Mysteries, An Internet Urban Legend Comes to Life, a fascinating read. Nick Redfern, please tell our listeners where you can get the book and find out more about your work.
Okay. Well, the book's called The Slender Man Mysteries. You can get it from Amazon online, all of the good book outlets online, and also you can buy it off the shelves in Barnes & Noble. And people can reach me at my blog, which is nickredfern14.blogspot.com.
Wonderful always to chat with you, Nick, and to talk about the work that you do. We have to have you back again soon, please.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Victor.
And thank you for joining us on Destination Unlimited. I'm Victor the Voice Furman. Have a wonderful day.